thanks, guys, and welcome to the hardware track. This is not absolutely about hardware, but it involves hardware as well. So my talk is about building a modern, robust, embedded Linux system. Platform. And before we actually begin, I'd like to do two things. To get to know you a little bit better, I'd like to play a round of buzzword bingo with you, just to see whether you recognize some of the catchphrases I'm going to use later in this talk. And then I'll tell you about myself and my motivation and why I'm here, and what I'm going to tell you. So, buzzword bingo. I just put some buzzwords on the slides, and I'd like you to, if you recognize them, if you know them, raise your hands, raise yourself, do anything crazy. Just signal me that that this is something you knew. You know. Sorry, I'm a little fast. Okay, Open Embedded, anyone? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. What are you doing with Open Embedded?
Doing nothing, I know about it.
So you know about it. What do you know about it?
It's a framework to build a embedded Linux distribution.
Yeah, that's roughly true. We have the last part of this talk solely focusing on Open Embedded and what you can do with it. Cross-compiler, anyone? What do you do with cross-compilers? Okay. Okay. So you cross-compile on Intel architecture for embedded architectures. Have you ever cross-compiled for Intel architecture on Intel architecture? Does it make any sense for you? No. Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, that's a good example of why you would do this. System D. You in the back, what are you doing with systemd? What do you know about that? So you're running Fedora? OpenSUSE? Okay, great. What is it doing for you? What does systemd do for you? It boots the system. Okay, it can do a bit more. We'll come to that later. That definitely is a buzzword. Software lifecycle management. There's one guest who dares. So what do you know about this? What is it for you? Sorry? It's a pain. That's true. Specifically, it's a pain to do right. In my point of view, transparent file systems, we're getting more specialized. Anyone?
Only knowing from Knuppix.
Okay. So, what does it do there? Any of you considered stuff like this for embedded systems? You did. Okay. Cool. So this is something I present in this talk, how you can make use of transparent file systems in your embedded system. And it's good to learn that the Open Wireless project and several other projects you named already use this. That's cool, because it opens up a lot of possibilities. AUFS is one of the transparent file systems. Anyone using this? Two. Great. The Linux MTD project, Memory Technology Devices. 1, 2, 3, 4. How are you using it? What is it for you? Yeah.
Only known from the NS7G from Linksys.
Okay.
This
so what do they do? What is their...
There's flash memory, and I can back up it by accessing the raw devices.
Okay. So they're handling flash memory. That's what they're specializing in. UBFS. Does this ring a bell? Yeah, you.
Flash memory storage.
Okay. Then what's the difference between UB and UBFS?
I have no idea.
Okay. UB is the part that handles the flash aware stuff, and UBFS is a file system that talks to UB. So you have static UB blocks, and you can put dynamic UBFS file systems in that. I won't have any of this in the talk, but we use it too. What is a NAND erase block? How about you?
Isn't this the size of the NAND
Yeah, it's the minimum size of a chunk of memory you can erase in a flash block. What that means in a few slides. Thanks for playing with me. It was fun. Now with me. There was this presentation at FOSDEM this year. This poor chap put on, Arno. It's a pretty good presentation. So if you care and download my presentation slides later on, I linked his presentations and I asked him to put his face on the wall so he knows about this. I'm not trying to do anything to him. And he was specifically focusing on the upgrade procedure on embedded systems and what can go wrong and whatnot. It was pretty interesting and the room was pretty crowded. So he made me thinking, people actually might want to know about stuff like this. It's not as boring as it might seem to you. So maybe you put your own thoughts into some slides and go to a presentation. So here's the direct cause for me being here today. And I want to kind of thank you for him for that. That was all about the introduction. And now there's some introductory part on the main topic of the talk. We will first present what I mean by using platform being a buzzword as well. So then present some challenges when trying to build a platform for especially embedded systems. Some of these challenges I stole from Arno, and other challenges he didn't even talk about because it wasn't about upgrading. But there's a lot more in platform building than might meet the eye even or especially if you're from the embedded sector. The main part of the talk will focus on concepts to counter these challenges and how to implement and integrate these concepts. Let's start. What's a platform? Car analogies were great. I mean, go to Slashdot, see all the car analogies. They explain things to you, right? So take a pickup or a bare-bone car. If you create and design this thing the right way, then you may repurpose the whole archetype of the thing later on, and I don't know, make it a transporter or make it a living home. So this has to be thought in at this point, right? So when you think about this, then you must at least leave enough options open to build this and that later. This specific platform is from Fiat. And it's so successful that other car manufacturers just use it, implement it. They switch the logo, and it's so versatile. So this is actually some kind of good thing if your competition uses your platforms for because it sells so well, because it builds so well, or it's so versatile or whatever. So a platform for me, what I want to talk today, it offers a solid base. So things are thought through. It also gives you a comprehensive set of customizations to build a number of very different distinct products out of that. So yeah, I can't get any more specific at this point, but maybe with the other stuff that's coming up, this will all make sense to you. I don't know. Okay, that was it for the platform. Any questions to here, till here? Oh, okay. Let's see some of the challenges. So when you're trying to develop an embedded system or a platform for a number of embedded systems, you have to think about how your system operates in the real world and how to counter some of the problems your system may encounter already in the platform. So some challenges I find easily to identify, at least if you're a bit experienced in embedded systems, is you have to, when planning for your system, you have to apply some kind of server thinking. It's not a desktop thing. It might exist in a remote place, stuff like that. You have very interesting failure vectors in embedded systems. And this is may not be so obvious if your competition should use your platform because it's so good. Then you also have to think about the platform building itself. How do you present all the features? How do you make yourself reusable? Okay, this is what I mean by server thinking. Your embedded system might be a measurement device being at that place. So sending the system administrator out to press the reset button to power cycle the whole thing might be expensive here, although still possible. It's not feasible. it can get even more expensive. In the point with the platform idea is that other users of your platform can build systems that might do this at some point. So you don't even know about that, but you want your platform thought through enough, well enough, so as to enable your users to actually build stuff that runs on these places. And I mean, this is no fantasy, right? This is not a nerd's dream here. If you check the internet, on the website of SpaceX, the American space company, they are currently looking for embedded Linux developers. So your stuff could run up there. That could be your platform. Okay, so this server thinking thing. You have to consider accessibility. Is your device reachable at any point in time physically? Probably not. Is it reachable in a network via network connections? There might be scheduled time slots where you have network. So you have to think about not having network all the time. It's a bit about error and sanity detection. So the first thing to identify in your system, the first thing to know is everything good? So detect errors, have sanity checks into place. And if you really want to act on the information of an error or a not-so-sane circumstance, then you have to implement fallback modes before the error happens, right? So you can, go back to a system state where everything was fine. And very importantly, very important fact when considering embedded workflows with the server thinking, you will have, at some point, critical operations. And you might want to find ways to make these operations, at least from a system perspective, act in an atomic way. So either it happened or it didn't happen. There's no in-between where a power failure can leave your system in an inconsistent state. So it's a lot about these basic principles that gives you a robust system. Okay, so what can go wrong? Your power can fail in a lot of very interesting ways. I mean, if just the power runs out, that's simple, right? So your system shuts down, and that's that. But what about if your power fails slowly? You still have the voltage, but the current drops, and then the voltage breaks in, and you have to take care for that. So there are some hardware additions you could put in your machine, like a brownout reset controller that will check voltage and currency at all the time, and then just pull the reset of the whole system if something seems unhealthy. If you don't have this and your power slowly fades, then single bits in your memory could flip and you wouldn't notice. Flash writes could go wrong. Flash erasers especially need a lot of power. So you have a power peak at this moment in your system. Fun thing is, if you run low on battery and you erase your flash, chances are your system will shut down. You have storage corruption. This is a feature of NAND flash. NAND flash is the least reliable non-volatile storage I know about. I have a whole slide on this kind of features of NAND flash. And you will, of course, have if you copy and transmit data inside of your system or from the outside, receive data, send data, you have always check the data before you process it. So you have to check for transmission errors. Very interesting features if you start thinking about upgrading your systems, then are compatibility issues. So this is software life. This is a problem software lifecycle management tries to solve, right? And I explicitly mention config here because compatibility for an embedded device is not only some APIs between some processes, but also is the new version of my application interpreting the system configuration or the application configuration every bit as good as the old software did? Because if configuration goes wrong in a device, for your customer, for your user, the device is broken. It's not if you configure something wrong with your desktop that you can erase the configuration files, start the whole thing up in default mode, and everything is fine. For your customer, there might not be a difference between buggy software and misinterpreted configuration. And that's an experience we've had a lot of times, so I think this is important to mention. You have all kind of fringe situations from the environment. The voltage thing was only one example of that. You might have high moisture, not enough moisture. You might have a lot of pressure around you, not enough pressure. You might have temperature changes that influence your hardware in a very subtle way and makes bit flip and software rot. So it's a rough world out there. In a server room, everything is climated and everything is fine. But if you put your embedded system out in space, I mean, right? So you have to prepare for hardware fails, for bit fails all the time. It's very, very important here. And after that, you still have real software bugs to handle. Platform building. I want you to use my embedded Linux platform for your next project. I want you to integrate your machine, follow my requirements for the platform, and then provide a board support package in my platform. I want you to use it. How do I get you to use it? For instance, if I offer ready-made applications, exactly the kind of applications you were always looking for, but you can't get cross-compiled because, I don't know, it's too... too hard to do manual all the time. It's a dependency thing, whatever. So I want a extensible application catalog so that you can just pick what you want for your embedded system, like from a menu. I don't want you to get hunting for your own cross-compiler. I want my platform to provide cross-compiling power to you. And I want this integrated in the platform, as well as my build system, debugging tools. I want software lifecycle management in the platform. So this is package management plus some extras. And I want, of course, the whole thing is easily extendable, and the whole plan is to get you to use this thing and then build your own stuff upon it, on top of that. These are the two catchphrases from the title of the talk. Modern software is a state-of-the-art software. Package management, I love package management, it's awesome. I want it in every embedded system I use, which gives me some problems, but even more cool things to do. So I'm trying to solve the problems to get all the useful stuff in. And I fell in love with the new event-driven inits that fly around, like Upstart or Systemd. So this is something I would have in my platform, in a platform that I'm going to use. It should be robust. So my platform should guarantee for my system not being breakable in development, at least. If it offers package management and whole image upgrades, it should do so in a very reliable way. And it should give me some kind of system configuration, some fallback concept methodology already in the platform. Because this is a hard problem, architecture-wise. You don't want to solve it every time you create a new device. Ah, where's the time? Let's now face the main part of the talk, which are the concepts. Okay, so now this is about the real stuff. Everyone's still awake. That's really great. So this is basically the part where I wake you up, because this is where it gets interesting. We will first set some system and hardware requirements, and we will see how this will help us for a robust platform. These are requirements if you build a device, then your device has to fulfill these to actually make use of the platform I'm offering to you. But you will like these requirements because you will like the features the platform makes out of the requirements. Then we will spend a lot of time hardening all the critical challenges, the critical operations I mentioned. And after all, at the end of the talk, I'll give you a short overview how Open Embedded can help you integrate all the cool concepts and things you came up with in the first two parts. Setting requirements helps you to make your platform and all machines that are supported by your platform more reliable. It helps you to use uniform concepts over all different machines you're supporting. You can set requirements performance-wise. That's the obvious thing, right? You can also use system requirements to make every device unbreakable, to put in place to realize your unbreakable feature of your platform. You might need certain hardware requirements of devices you're supporting. And you may even set requirements on internal storage technology. That is so where your rootFS, where your bootloader, and where your kernel is. If you give requirements out for this, then you can highly optimize the way it is handled. And your job as a platform designer, or my job, is to integrate the requirements very well into features that you can actually use, so you see a sense in following the requirements for the platform. System performance requirements, you might at some point see that 16 megabytes of RAM is not enough for even booting up your platform because you decided for, I don't know, which service to start up by default at all. So you might set a minimum RAM requirement. You might require certain interfaces to be there, like storage interface, static memory interface. You can talk to NAND, SATA interface to store stuff on. You might require a certain CPU power for your platform to be useful. A hardware side dual boot is a very specific and nice requirement we use in our project. So we require the machines that we're supporting to have certain hardware features or embedded features that at least behave like hardware features. So you can always boot the device from the internal default, the production system that runs the business logic. But you can also unbrick your device in development by booting from an external device. And this should be hardware. As I said, this makes your device, at least during development, completely unbrickable. So you can make mistakes. And this is important. It's important to be able, in development, to make mistakes, right? You learn from mistakes. And if you brick your device with mistakes, you feel a certain remorse, or you might. I don't know. If you feel that remorse, this might even avoid that you see your mistake, because you're just angry about the whole thing. So you should be happily able to destroy the whole thing, because one or two simple steps will make it live again. So I think this is very important. And it also gives you fast in-field recovery. So if you send all your administrator in the space suite up to your satellite to restore the system because something went dead wrong, you don't want to hand him a 20-page instruction manual on what to do up there. You just want to give him a stick or something. He's going to jam it to the device, power it up, wait for the green lamp to light up, and then go back home. So how would you do that? The hardware boot, this might be supported by your system on a chip. This might be supported by some external logic that is treated like hardware, so it's never updated. And it's to do some simple things. You boot up, you check whether an external boot device is present. If it's present, you just boot it. And then command goes over to the external device. It would check itself, am I rescue, am I development, am I something else? If it's development, it gives your developers the debugging environment to work with the device. If it's a rescue thing, it could automatically, from the bootloader or somewhere, flash the whole internal system and then light up this green LED so you can take your storage away and go home. And then it would boot up just as usual. Having this in-field is really a great thing, because usually the people you send out to fix your systems, if they're broken, they might be, I don't know, just some guy you met on the street that you pay some dollars to fix stuff up for you. You don't want to rely on anything that this guy is doing, and you don't want to have to check whether he did correctly. With a very simple one-step instruction, jam it in, you're pretty safe. And don't remember, never ever, if you emulate it, change it. So this is a hardware requirement, right? So if someone says, let's do something more intelligent here, just say, I can't, it's hardware. I won't touch it. Internal storage requirement offers you a single point of optimization. So if your platform decides we are using NAND flash for the rootFS, then you can optimize this thing throughoutly. You can debug, bug check, whatever the few drivers you're requiring to actually talking to NAND. You can write your own file systems on that and implement some ideas in that. And it wouldn't work on systems that don't have this kind of storage. So you have more robust code and workflows. And you can opt for a common file system layout and some more features that are very storage device centric. I'll have a few examples on that, especially on NAND flash later. So for instance, you can come up with a partitioning. The default partitioning every single device your platform supports will have. And tools and programs can rely on that and can work on that. So setting requirements the right way can increase the perceived degrees of freedom. Of course, setting requirements usually take away degrees of freedom. But since they also take away a lot of risk if you require the right things, then it might, for your users, increase their degrees of freedom, what they can do with your platform. And you can use this to provide reliable platform features to all the system. And it even enables you for basic platform concepts if you decide for one special, one explicit technology to do one thing and don't have to support like 10 kinds of root file system storage. So this might actually be a good thing. Think about it when setting up your next embedded system. Yeah, now for the largest part, system hardening. So all the features I mentioned before, I want to enjoy in a reliable way. So you first take a look at your kernel, the way it's stored, and the rootfs, and what you can do about it to make it more reliable. And then we will take a look at system upgrade. And this is where I stole some of Arno's ideas from. So this is his whole talk just focuses on problems you encounter with system update. It's much more detailed. And since I'm a huge fan of package management, I got to harden this. And this might be hard. So what do I mean? What concepts do I use for hardening things? I keep my data redundant, my applications. So I have the old version and I have the new version. And when it turns out that the new version doesn't work as well, I can still fall back to the old version. It's really that cycle. You have the new version, you check sanity for a while, and if it doesn't look sane, you can fall back. So this is a very, very simple basic pattern you can apply at a lot of places in a platform. Like, for instance, the flash layout I mentioned before. If you see that, we have two partitions for a kernel. We have two partitions for the rootfs. So this enables me to live in one partition, boot this partition, and do something else with the other partition, and then maybe do an atomic operation or whatnot to switch these. This is redundancy in a very, very simple form. It's plainly redundant. It's 100% redundant. You can use this to boot into a known good system. A very simple process of doing so would: your bootloader just checks whether your last boot was okay. Keep in mind that last boot could mean I booted into this kernel, the new one, and here's the old kernel that is proved working. Whoops, wrong button. And so he checked whether the last boot worked out. If it worked out, boot the current system. We will see what happens after that. If it doesn't, you can still boot the fallback, which is proven to work. If, however, you're sure that you can boot the current system, one simple thing to do is just set a timer or run some diagnostics and then declare yourself healthy. So next time the bootloader comes around, you're the fallback. Yeah. This is a really great feature. We are implemented halfway through. However, I really like the concept behind that. So we use a read-only rootfs. I think lots of embedded systems do that. So you can't actually break anything in your rootfs because you can't even write to the flash. Doesn't work. For volatile data, we use tempfs mounted at a variety of places in the system. And if you want to store non-volatile data, like, I don't know, data for application or whatnot, we use a transparent overlay file system for this non-volatile data. Now, how do transparent overlay file systems work? Imagine that is your rootfs. Simple read-only file system you can't read, you can't write to. You mount, if you have it mounted on root, then you mount your transparent file system on top of that. So what happens if you mount something on top of something else? Usually, if it's an opaque file system, everything below that you can't see it anymore. It's basically gone for you. For a transparent file system, this is not true. So if you mount your overlay on top of that, you can see through. So if there is nothing in the transparent layer and you do a read of a specific file, this read will go to the layer below that. However, if you modify something, if you do a write, the write will happen to the transparent overlay, and then if you read again, you read from the transparent overlay without noticing, right? If you delete something, your transparent overlay will create something called a whiteout. A whiteout basically means that you can't see through anymore and that there's nothing. So if you try to open that file again, you will get no such file or directory. The real fun thing is the backend storage for these file systems can be completely different. Like your rootfs can be in one MTD partition, and the data you're writing to your rootfs can be in another partition or even in another storage device. And I think this is a pretty cool feature. So to take the whole thing from some kind of different perspective, we have our read-only rootfs in one of the rootfs partitions. We have a read-write layer above it, and all the data of the read-write layer are stored in a simple directory of a third file system. In this case, we apply UB, and it's in the last partition over there. Okay, so how can we make use of that? We can by doing one single call of mount. We can add new read-write layers on top of existing ones, turning all below layers into read-only layers. That is, you can have snapshots, right? You can stack as many read-only overlays on top of each other as you like, up to a point. And the topmost one will always be the other way around. Read-write will only be the topmost one, because it doesn't make sense to have read-write layers in between, right? You can't reach them anyways through the other layers. You just want snapshots and fallbacks for your embedded system, file system-wise. And this is actually a cool thing, and we will use it to harden package management. So how do we get system upgrade right without breaking anything that actually works on your device? System upgrade is about transmission sanity. I mentioned that before, which is a key issue in embedded systems. You need to atomically switch if everything went well. So the one moment, it's the old system. The next moment, it's the new system. And there's no time in between where your power can fail and you're into an inconsistent state. You even might think about having some system upgrade state, system state, like a certain number of performance-hungry applications are shut down. You free some memory, so you're all set up for receiving the update. Some key things you should always keep in mind when planning for an upgrade workflow is you should check some everything. Of course, that happens in advance, because if you don't do it, you can't edit later. So put checksums to your image files before you transmit them. Cache your downloads. I think it's a really bad habit, even if it saves RAM and storage and whatnot, to download and write into the destination at the same time, because I think you lose more than you gain. First, verify what you downloaded, because it's cached somewhere, I don't know, verify it. Then write it. And after that, after all went well, then it's the time to switch. In order to perform this atomic switch, I'll just put a workflow for that on the next two slides. But we will have some short facts about NAND flash before that. So NAND flash is organized in pages of erase blocks. That means a page is about 1K or 2K or 4K for the very large devices. And a number of pages make up a erase block. Erase block is 64K, 128K, so it's about that size. You can only have so many writes per page, and then the NAND will go bad. For the larger devices, these are like 3 or 4 writes per page, and then you have to erase the whole erase block to in order to do writes again. Writes themselves only have the capability of flipping ones in the flash to zeros. You can't write a one. You can only write zeros. If you want to have a one, then you need to erase the whole block. The block is a large thing, the 128K thing. So all the ones will get up again. And the whole erase block, all the pages in the erase block, will consist of all ones. And then you can start flipping the ones again. And this is NAND flash, and it's horrible. I mean, especially the larger devices nowadays, they tend to degrade by just reading them. So you keep reading, and the bits flip. I mean, what the? But okay, you can handle it. It's a raw device. It needs very special treatment, and you should take care on time to actually treat it very well. So how do we switch atomically after an update? We use our redundant storage, and there's this small partition called bootconfig. Bootconfig uses some features of NAND flash, so it's NAND aware. And what we currently do, it can be improved. What we currently do is we use the first page of every erase block to store some boot information. That's a huge waste. You can, of course, use every page in that erase block because the maximum number of writes you're doing to a page before re-erasing the whole thing is 2. You will have maximum two writes maximum. One such a bootconfig consists of such an info block. So you have a magic just to see, yeah, this was actually written there by intent. You have an epoch. Epoch's basically an increasing number starting by 1 in the bootconfig blocks. And the most current bootconfig block is identified by having the highest epoch. I'll have some workflow on how to work with bootconfig one slide later, so keep tuned. Then you have a timestamp for information purposes only. So if you read your boot blocks, your boot configurations, you can check when it was actually written. And the really important thing is kernel flags and rootfs flags of such a boot configuration. We are currently using only 3 bits of these flags. There is a partition bit determining whether this information is for partition 0 or partition 1. We're working with redundancy here, so it's only 0 or 1 required at that point. Then we have a flag. Did it boot? And after it booted, was it healthy? And it works like this. If you, at the time when you write your update, you erase the oldest identified by the epoch or invalid entry. I'll come to invalid entries in a second. Then you write your new boot configuration into that place, and you set your epoch, the most current epoch plus 1. So you're the most current record then. And the thing to know is that we use the bit number 1 as false. So 1 represents false in this scenario. Just to keep some actual features of the flash. So the time you write this, your entry will never have booted, so booted is false, and your entry won't be determined healthy, so healthy is false. 1 is false, remember. This is why it's red, right? 0 is true. Okay, then you boot your system. Your bootloader will identify the latest valid entry by the epoch, will flip the booted flag to 0, saying, yeah, this has booted, and then boot the partition. And when you boot it into your system, you might start a safety timer, you might run some sanity checks, and then at the point when you're sure that you're healthy, you might flip that bit. And this is just one simple way to do an atomic switch. If, of course, your system is being reset for some reason and you're not able of flipping that switch, then you're not healthy. And if your bootloader encounters an entry that has booted 0 and healthy 1, he just discarded. That would be an invalid entry. That was what I mentioned before. Because this system is definitely not healthy. It has been booted before. It has not declared itself healthy. It's not healthy. Oh, I gotta hurry. Okay. So, the more interesting thing, hardening package management. Remember system upgrade? It was so easy there. You check some, you cache your downloads, you verify it, then you write, and then you switch atomically. So why don't just do this for package management as well? There are certain problems with this. Your package has multiple files. It has some configurations, has some logic to set up in the system. So where do you write this and how do you switch atomically later on? Remember transparent overlays. I said it uses a simple directory for storing all the changes. So how exactly does it do that? How does it store its data? If you write something on a transparent overlay and then detach it from the read-only rootfs and then check the actual storage backend at some path somewhere and see what's written there, then we'll find exactly that. So we will see the exact content of the changes file-wise, directory-wise in that storage backend directory. So all your changes are represented there one by one. So plus some management files, which a UFS uses to keep track of whiteouts and stuff. So what you can actually do, you can write on your root file system, on the AUFS, and you can check the back end and can watch the files appearing there because they're actually generated there. It makes you wonder, does it work the other way? Like, if you tell your package management, hey, put your stuff here. This is your root. And then change your perspective on the whole thing and don't see it as a package management root, but as a new layer of a transparent overlay, which is read-only. And then could you try to atomically integrate that into your system so you have your atomic switch? Well, that was your system. So you have your read-write overlay, you have your rootfs, and what you can do is you can remount the whole thing, which happens atomically, and you can flip your read-only transparent overlay between these with one system call that also operates atomically. And this gives you atomic package management. It's a nice trick. So for hardening, we are aiming for a redundant kernel and redundant rootfs. It seems like a waste, but NAND flash is really, really cheap. So what gives? We always look for atomic switches when we do something new. And if we do sanity checks, we also need fallbacks. Because why are we doing the sanity checks if you don't have anything to fall back to, if the sanity fails? And especially if you haven't heard it before, and my poll at the start of the talk suggested that you didn't, have a look at transparent file systems. No one seems to use them, and they're so cool. You can build all kind of amazing stuff with it. For instance, atomic package install. Sorry? No, let's do this with Q&A because I have 2 minutes left. So my last part of the talk will be how to put this all together. And it could also be called Open Embedded, which I think it is. So what gives you Open Embedded? It gives you a software development kit. You get cross-compilers. You get build tools. All is sandboxed. Nothing you build with Open Embedded is dependent in any way on your host. And this is a very important thing. Because Open Embedded, the first thing it does, it builds its own set of tools to build things. It has literally thousands of apps because there are so many people involved in it. You have like a GNOME layer, a KDE layer, a whatnot layer, XFCE layer, if you're into desktops, I don't know. For industry, you have special things integrated. You can choose from all the modern applications. You have built-in package management. That's me again. Yeah. And it's a huge, lively community and a lot of sub-projects you can all make use of because the whole thing is very pluggable. So they have this layer concept. The layer is basically a collection of build instructions that build several applications that serve a certain purpose. So you have core layers that gives you core image functionality. You have board support package layers that enable your whole system to build for, I don't know, ARM, MIPS, Intel. You have distribution layers that give you high-level distribution features like systemd integration for a set of jobs. And you have tools layers for stuff you might need at one point or another and that's in there and doesn't fit any other layer or purpose. And one of the benefits as well is it's so easy to extend. The apps in Open Embedded are often very recent. They're state of the art. And they are well maintained because it's a huge community and these guys all seem to love latest and greatest. So you have the latest stuff in Open Embedded in the packages. The package management in Open Embedded is throughout. Open Embedded will generate a system image by installing all the packages that make up the image in a sandbox and then give you the image. Where's the advantage in that? If you put your image on your embedded system and you're connected interactively to your embedded system, you can ask it, what versions of what software do you have installed? This file, which package belongs it to? What are the dependencies on that package? And this basically, if used in the right way, there's the end of talk sign, gives you application lifecycle management. You can use it to integrate your own stuff, your own ideas, the concepts I just described, at certain points and make it reusable for other open embedded users. So they can just unplug your layer, plug it in their own layer stack, and make use of some of your concepts they choose to use. You can override other things that happen in other layers you're using. You can streamline your system of, for instance, what we do is we streamline our system into using systemd for everything. So we don't have any application running on init anymore. You can do this by just overriding the small parts of some layers that didn't that don't use systemd right now. That's basically what I just told. You can have your current system states, like the update state. That's remember the old init thingy, init 4, init 6? Without some, what was init 5? What? What was init 5? I mean, what was it 4? What I can do with modern init replacements is I can build myself semantic system states. Like, for instance, systemd, please enter the system upgrade target, which shuts down everything that's not in that target and prepares the whole system for whatever I want to do with it. So it's a great thing to remote control your whole system into a certain state. You can integrate your own features, as I said. Like, we have a package for transparent overlay. So if you want this stuff, this transparent overlay in your embedded system, then just pull our distribution layer and use our package. Install a package and you're done. Or the boot config tools. The same for the board support package layers. You can take advantage of your own hardware requirements and put them in place into these overrides. You can, for instance, like integrate the storage layout, patch the kernel in the right way, so it will always have your storage layout. You can the rest of your system, the rest of your platform can rely on that, and you can make use of boot config features at boot time because bootloader is always very system specific and is probably found in the board support package. So if you opt for custom layers, be pluggable, be reusable, and try to build a foundation for others. Try to be a real platform. To sum it all up, and this will be the end of my talk, Open Embedded basically gives me a huge playground to integrate all of my concepts that I presented to you in a way that you can use them. That's the whole plan, right? That's the platform thing I'm talking about all the time. So I can jam it in there and can provide that to you and give you that kind of platform. It's great for that kind of stuff. If you want to play with any of these things, have a look at HiDev. HiDev is our it's a platform we started with Open Embedded, and some of these ideas are already implemented there. So you have packages for some of the stuff. Go there and check it out if you'd like to try. And this now really is the end. We still have time for questions?
Of course.
Of course. Okay. Any questions?
Are there differential image update features?
Image update features? Not that I know of. You could provide such kind of a feature in Open Embedded. It's easily to extend, as I said. But I would rather, if it's about a partial upgrade, I would rather take the package management path because that could be easier. But it's not there. Such a feature is not there, as I'm aware of. More questions? Yeah?
Has the UFS finally found its way into the upstream journal? UFS,
according to the Linux kernel maintainers, will never find its way into the upstream kernel, which is understandable if you take a look at that, because it copies some semantics of the Linux kernel and implements it in its own way instead of using the kernel. But AUFS is actively maintained by a rather large community. So you get constant updates, and people seem to actually use it. So I don't know about UnionFS. It's a university thing, and I've heard it has been pretty unstable in between, but it seems to be back in the game. So no, I don't think AUFS will never enter the kernel. I don't think AUFS will ever enter the kernel. I've heard of AUFS instability, but we don't use it in the way where it gets unstable. So these guys really create some fringe situations where you have multiple read-write layers where you actively write in the storage backend of AUFS. So it has to reflect the changes up. And they do some kind of crazy stuff we are not doing. When did you, the question was, how about open embedded documentation you couldn't find one when you took a look last time around? How much time?
Two years ago.
The open embedded manual, that's a, you can buy a paper version, but there are multiple versions online. And the Bitbake manual should give you all that you need to know. And they're like linked in the front page. So did you find them not useful, or didn't you find them at all? Okay.
Okay. So,
The statement was that it is actually kind of hard to introduce a new distribution or a new board to Open Embedded because there's no how to do this. That's right. Anyways, I think the manual is pretty good in explaining the concepts and basics, and getting you started, and the mailing lists are pretty helpful too. So if you run into problems, these guys are really great and active and helpful. Yeah, take a look at Open Embedded. Definitely, it's worth it. Yeah.
So how does Open Embedded compare like to other solutions?
Oops.
It seems like every hardware manufacturer, like Freescale, has its own system, and then NVIDIA has its own system.
Yeah.
Distributions, and everybody's doing it like in its own way.
So the question was how Open Embedded compares to other systems like PDXDist or Open Wireless or stuff like that. Well, from my point of view and what I've seen from the other distributions, it's the most comprehensive set. So you have the most applications integrated there, and the fact that that you get your cross compiler built by your Open Embedded, I didn't encounter this in any of the other built environments. And to the point that you made that every developer, every manufacturer seems to favor its own embedded build framework. That seems to come to an end because. There are board support package layers in Open Embedded where chip manufacturers officially support their chips. Currently, it's Intel and Texas Instruments, and there's more to come. Okay, I think we're going to quit and make room for the next presentation.
Next talk in this room starts at 4:15.
All right. Okay, cool.